This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net. Who survives when an internet access brain implant pits spouse against spouse, brother against sister, and governments against their people? This April, it's time to honor the past, embrace the present, and seize the future with R.R. Campbell's Mourning Dove, the second installment in his epic empathy sci-fi saga. For more, visit empathyseries.com. This is episode 13 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, and we're all in it together.
Hey there, I'm author, editor, and RightsCast Network founder R.R. Campbell.
And I'm Sienna Ashleman, freelance editor, companion to the shediest dog that ever lived, and co-host of the Novel Approaches podcast.
In this installment of Novel Approaches, we'll be exploring the ins and outs of The Darkest Moment, including what it is, how it compares with The Dark Night of the Soul, and how we go about setting ourselves up for the inclusion of either or both. But first, Sion, Rev Pitt is here. How pumped are you?
Woo! I am super pumped! How about you?
Feeling pretty good. Feeling ready this year. You know, this is my second time around the block, so I've shed the nervousness that came with last year, and I'm ready to rock.
You did? How do you shed the nervousness? I'm nervous every time.
You know, you've compared me in the past to the dog that's in the burning room and saying everything is fine, and there's just so many fires in the room right now that I don't have time to be nervous about any of them. I'm just like, all right, this is the one I'm going to look at for a few moments, and Rev Pitt is that fire.
Okay, I'm gonna not address the part where you said that I compared you to the dog, because that's fine. Maybe I did.
It was a few episodes ago. It's on record. We've got a recording of this.
Oh, no. We have audio proof that I did that. There's no arguing with that. Why can't we just, like, erase that and go by memory? I'm, like, so excited for a pit. For me, it's better than Christmas. It's like when I start thinking about, you know, I'm looking at the feed and seeing what everybody's working on and answering questions, and I'm thinking about what's going to land in my inbox, and it's like, yeah, it's better than Christmas. It's like, because you get like 100 presents, not like a couple, you know what I'm saying?
And they're all surprising too, honestly. You never really know what you're gonna get. There's no like Rev Pitt Santa Claus that you can go to and say like, hey man, this is what I really want this year. I mean, that's kind of what our manuscript wish list is, but that's also general. It's like saying, I want, you don't, you're not asking for a pony, you're like, I'd like an animal, and you have no idea what you're gonna get. That was a reach. Yeah. I'll admit that was a reach. I tried.
That's okay. That's all right. We as in me and Milton, we like your weird metaphors and analogies.
And I just want to confirm earlier when you mentioned that Milton was he was some sort of superlative dog. You did in fact say sheddiest dog.
Yeah, I said sheddiest.
I was worried.
I have a master's in the English language. That means I get to make things up. Okay?
No, I was on board. I was on board with the word. I'm on board with the wordplay. My concern was that you used a different vowel in the first syllable of the word. And I was like, oh, no, don't be mean to Milton.
Oh, no. Did it sound like I said that he's not nice, not good?
Sheddiest.
Yeah. Well, I think the Rev Pitt excitement has gotten to him, and he's just losing all his fur. It's either that or spring, but I'm going to go with Rev Pitt.
All right, let's do it. We'll have it be Rev Pitt. It sounds like also, I know you've got AWP coming up, or by the time this airs, will that have concluded?
Yes, by the time this airs, that will have happened. We're actually recording at a different time of the month than usual, because next week is the Association of Writers and Writing Programs National Conference. And it just happens to be in Portland this year, which is where I live. And so I'm super excited for that. and also incredibly overwhelmed because they have like over 550 events, and that's not including offsite events.
Wow.
Like, yeah, it's a huge deal, and like everybody's talking about it, and then there are all of these unofficial events that I'm getting notifications for, and my head is about to explode already. So I'm like, last night I was journaling about like, what are my goals, what do I want to get out of this, and how do I not just fall apart after the first 4 hours, because I get overstimulated quite easily in large crowds.
Yeah, it's easy to do at conferences like that, and I think it's smart that you're taking the time to make a list of the goals that you have for it as well, because at any conference, especially one that size, I mean, it's just nice to go into it knowing that you have this sort of idea of what you're after, because it can kind of help keep you feeling grounded, because overstimulation, I think, is, it can be a problem for anyone. I mean, I'm someone who will often go to conferences and I feel just kind of anxious about it because it is a lot of people. But then rather than get like over, maybe it is overstimulation that gets to me, and having goals in mind and knowing like, all right, these are the sessions that I want to go to, this is what I truly want to get out of it, I'm gonna have to try that this year. I need to find my center and get grounded. So that's a good tip. I like that.
Well, one of the things I'm working on is like really setting very minimal goals, I guess. Yes, I want to take advantage of it because, like, I don't know if I'll ever go to this conference again or how long it'll be if I do go again. But if I try and, like, do all the things and give in to my FOMO, then I'm just going to lose it. And so I'm like, if I get, like, three things out of this, you know, like a new friend, a new idea for a market to submit to, and some new ideas about, you know, queer speculative fiction, then I will be happy. Nice. That will be a win, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, what do you have going on this month?
So I also, by the time this episode airs, will have had my first conference of conference season, which is the University of Wisconsin Writers Institute. So that's double the reason why we are recording this one a bit early. I will be leading 4 sessions at that conference. I submitted 4 proposals, didn't think they'd accept all 4, and they did. So I will be a busy boy on the first 2 days of the conference, and the last 2 days will be for me to just be a private citizen, hopefully, attending and just learning as much as I can, because I will not have my eyes on the clock for when my next session starts. So.
Wow. Well, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Are you like, did it occur to you to say, I won't do all 4?
No, because I have trouble saying no to anything. And also, it is a really, I mean, it's a great opportunity. I love this conference. I've gone to it a few times now. I think it was 2013, 2017, 2018, and the relationships that I've made with other writers and editors and the agents I've met there, and it's a really welcoming community. And after being there last year and having an opportunity to like really talk about the podcasts that, you know, I don't think we were doing these podcasts quite yet at this time. I think it was shortly after that conference, but that really got me motivated to create kind of what we have here now, which is the RightsCast Network series of podcasts. That was kind of my foot in the door, so I'll be doing a session on podcasting there, and 3 sessions on various topics related to the craft of writing. So, yeah, I mean, I'll be busy, but you know what? I'm a planner. I already have my sessions designed and ready to go. I'm just going to do some, you know, walkthroughs of them next week, and fingers crossed that there are no technical difficulties on the day of or anything.
Well, that's awesome. Have fun with that.
Yeah, thanks. I'm excited about that. And I'll talk about it in future episodes as well, I'm sure, of this podcast. But I'll have a book tour coming up this spring all across the state of Wisconsin, hitting up Madison, Beloit, Eau Claire, Madison again for WisCon, which is going to be really awesome because that's sci-fi and fantasy focused. And I also found out yesterday that I will be leading 2 sessions there, which is really cool because that'll be another opportunity to meet some new folks. But that's a couple months away. I got plenty of time for that. And then, yeah, La Crosse, Green Bay, Columbus. I'm going everywhere. I'm coming to a town near you. It's like I'm running for office, but I'm not. So watch out. My bus is coming through your town.
So you said Wisconsin sci-fi fantasy. So my assumption is this book tour is for Empathy Imminent Dawn, is that right?
Yeah, so it'll be for the Empathy series in general, because what's actually going to be really neat is with Imminent Dawn having come out in January, by the time the tour really kicks off, which will be end of April and getting into May, at that point, the second book in the series, Mourning Dove, will be out. That actually comes out April 29th. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the last episode before that one comes out. So if you're looking for some sci-fi to add to your reader's diet, head on over to empathyseries.com. You can learn all about the first two books there and maybe catch me on the tour if you're in the Midwest and want to swing by one of our many small cities that we have here in our lovely state. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's what I got. But I think what we got ahead of us here is a conversation about Darkest Moments. And we had a pretty nice RightsCast chat on this one this last Tuesday. We had Cinna, who is one of our very dedicated RightsCast chatters, as well as Angela Super, who joined us for a for this particular session. So we started that chat out by asking those who were attending, so to speak, to define the darkest moment. So that sounds like a good place for us to start as well. I don't know, Sion, do you want to lead with Cinna's definition here?
Cinna, which is asset, C-I-N-A-E-D-H-V-I-K. That's the Twitter handle. He said, I think the darkest moment could mean many things. It is when options are fewest and poorest, or when the character is at their morally worst. Maybe both. The darkest moment is the closest they come to being a villain, maybe too. So what do you think about that?
I really liked that. I think the one that resonated most with me was the final bit about how the character can come close to being a villain. And the reason that I like that is because it creates this dichotomy. It plays into like the protagonist-antagonist dichotomy. And I don't know, it started getting me questioning the nature of like what it means to be a villain. Because if you really think about how we craft antagonists, even one thing that I've found to be very effective is to create antagonists that have reasons to believe that they're the protagonist of their own story. And so when we're following a story where we have a protagonist that we've been cheering for, that we've been rooting for, and we suddenly see them tempted, that really creates a complicated set of emotions, not only, of course, for the character in question, but for us as readers. It really has us reevaluating the relationship that we have with that character, whether or not we should continue to root for them. We are left with questions about whether they're actually going to take this action to perhaps become the villain. And it creates a darkest moment, not only for that character, but perhaps for us as readers too, which I thought was really something worth considering. So that's kind of where I landed on it anyway. What did you have to think about defining darkest moment?
Well, just to tack on to what you were saying, because I also found this idea of it being a moment where the protagonist is like the closest he'll ever come to being a villain. I found that a really interesting idea to meditate on. And it reminded me of, I went to the Martha's Vineyard Institute for Creative Writing last summer, which I think I've talked about times on here.
Yeah.
And one of the faculty, Randy Beck, she led a little session, and one of the things that we were working on is sort of how to push your characters over the edge. And she said, what is the worst thing that could possibly happen to your protagonist? That was like part one. And part two was, what could happen that would result in your protagonist's ego death? And I found those questions really interesting too. And so I'm just like putting them out there to tack on to Cinna's idea that it's the closest they become to a villain. I really like that.
Yeah, and I'm curious too about this point of it being the worst thing that could happen to a character, because I feel like there might be this knee-jerk reaction for the worst thing being, well, they could die. And I think that that could play into this sort of idea that, you know, we're going to have these cliffhangers. We've talked a lot about scene structure and goal-oriented storytelling and cliffhangers and an over-reliance on them, particularly this notion that, oh, what if the character might die at the end of the chapter? And then you have to turn the page to find out if they come back. How do you see, you know, what would you say to writers who have that knee-jerk reaction of, well, the worst thing that could happen is that they die?
I would actually argue that, well, I mean, I guess it depends on what it is that's important to your character. But when I thought about it for my own characters, there are fates that are worse than death. And that's where I think it gets really, really interesting. We applied this to both protagonists and villains, but for my villain, the worst thing that could happen to him is to be embarrassed and to not be in control of the situation. And I was really tickled and to find out that I had already written that moment in. I was like, oh, that's what I was doing. Like, yes.
It's nice when it works out that way. It really is.
And for my protagonist, for her, the worst thing she could find out is that she was, I'm trying to recapture it. It's like something about she was unintentionally harming people. And anyway, so yeah, that wasn't very articulate, but I was really tickled to find that I had done it both times. And so I think, yeah, I think it is, the worst thing is that they could die. And I do think that those can be compelling stakes, especially when they're related to, if they die, then the primary conflict will not be resolved. That's when it gets even better. But I do think that if you really like sink into your character's mind and ask them like, what could happen that would for you be worse than physical death, where you would no longer feel like you are the person that you have always thought yourself to be? I think that's a really interesting question.
And I think that's a really good way to phrase it too. And I'll add one final note on this notion of like a character actually physically dying, perhaps being a darkest moment. I think you make a really good point about how if the character were to physically die, it would mean that the primary conflict, you know, isn't necessarily resolved, or perhaps that it is resolved, but in such a way that it's going to have broader consequences for characters that the reader might also be invested in, particularly in a multi-POV, you know, narrative style. That's actually something that just this morning I found myself toying with and kind of smirking as I finished writing this chapter, because I'm doing all the things that I say I'm not supposed to do over the course of these conversations, where I finish this chapter and it's like, well, you don't know if that character's dead or not. Good luck out there, reader. And it's totally, I'm going to make you sit on it for a few chapters. But also, I think why it could work, or at least why I think that's going to work at this point in the narrative, is because for as much as you are presented with the possibility that this character has died, there's this kind of knowledge that, well, we've got an awful lot left to us here. And if they were to die, the story would go on. But if they don't die, the story will go on. It'll just take a different direction. And knowing that both directions are full of promise gives us an opportunity to sort of take advantage of this tool in our writer's toolkit without it feeling as though it is forced, or that we're just toying with readers' emotions to try and prove a point or to insert a darkest moment.
Okay, and so I'm going to just like segue on that, because that provides a really nice bridge. So for me personally, the way that I think about it is, because what you're talking about is a dark moment. A dark moment is a time in the narrative when anything that we don't want to happen happens. That's a dark moment. And that could include a character dying, right? But the darkest moment, a character dying is only the darkest moment if it means that the character dying will result in the primary conflict not being resolved triumphantly. That's the only time when a character death is the darkest moment. And so to go from there into my definition of the darkest moment in a book is when it looks like all is lost. That's that language. All is lost, that the primary conflict is not going to be resolved triumphantly. And if it's a tragedy, then that's probably like the last few pages of the book, because the primary conflict does not resolve triumphantly in a tragedy. But so, yeah, so that for me, that's the key, is that the darkest moment is about the book's primary conflict, when it looks like all is lost. And there can be lots of other dark moments that relate to the character arcs, but they're only, it's only going to be a darkest if whatever is the worst moment for that character is also the moment that means that they won't be able to resolve the primary conflict.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'll have to consider that as I, you know, reframe maybe in my own mind how I view that scene. Because one of the things that I find myself toying with is this notion that, and we'll get into this more, you know, where the darkest moment falls. And I'm thinking about this for, in my case, with a multi-perspective narrative. I think in this book, the way I have it divided out now, there's five or six perspective characters, and they all have darkest moments, and they all don't necessarily coincide within the broader structure of the work, as I've started to kind of think about this more actively. And so, yeah, those are really good points. I'll have to, just for my own sake, take a reevaluation there and see, you know, is this really just a dark moment, or is this truly the darkest moment as it relates to, you know, the primary conflict for that character, or perhaps the primary conflict of this particular book, or the primary conflict of the series as a whole. There's a lot of dimensions at play here, and
absolutely.
Yeah, certainly different shades to all this too, which actually I think gives us a nice little segue into our next bit here, which is kind of exploring a bit, not just darkest moments, but this dark night of the soul, and trying to compare these two. We had feedback from Angela Super over on Twitter, tweeting at all brevity wit. Angela says, the darkest moment is the moment when the main character loses everything or tosses it aside to achieve a goal. In Angela's mind, it's the same as the dark night of the soul, because the main character has to part with a bit of themselves to accomplish something big. So that was Angela's take on that. I'm curious, Sion, it sounds like you might see a difference between Dark Night of the Soul and the darkest moment.
I do. I actually find it really useful to distinguish between the two, because the Dark Night of the Soul relates to that character's arc. It's their, it could be several things. It could be the moment of their ego death. It could be like their lowest point, more like in terms of their morale or their morality. The moment when they're giving up, or when they're going to do something that is going to lead them, you know, down the dark path or whatever. It could be that they have to sacrifice a personal goal, something that they really, really wanted, in order to achieve a positive resolution to the primary conflict. It, like we said, it could be their death. And then that can get tied in also to their the character's fatal flaw, when it looks like they won't be able to overcome it and grow and change. So that is the dark night of the soul. And I think that it can be the same as the darkest moment if the primary conflict is the same as that character's conflict. And you see this in like literary fiction or literary speculative fiction, often in romance too, where it's the story is written in such a way that either the main conflict of the entire book is about that character's, a particular character's growth and their conflict, the thing that they're trying to get, happiness or closure on a relationship or something like that. Or like in romance, the in the best written romances, in my opinion, the people involved in the romance won't get their happily ever after if they don't change and grow. That's a really important part of what needs to happen. So if they hit that dark night of the soul moment, and it looks like that's going to prevent them from having a happy resolution to the love plot, then that's when they can be the same thing. But in a lot of other books, it is not the same thing, in my view.
With that, let's pause for a moment for a brief word from, well, me. Your book, Our Airwaves, Yes, It's True, Anything is Possible When You Advertise with the RightsCast Network. Hey there, I'm R.R. Campbell, RightsCast Network founder, and I'm here to let you know that you can now advertise your book, podcast, editing services, whatever creative endeavor, you can advertise it here on the RightsCast Network. Not only that, but you can advertise with us for less than a dollar a month. Yes, we offer packages for as little as less than a dollar a month. So get your book, your editing services, podcast, what have you, introduced to hundreds of new listeners by advertising with us today at rightscast.net/advertise or email me at rightscast@gmail.com and we can get started. Let's make it happen for you and your creative endeavors. That's your book, Our Airwaves, rightscast.net/advertise. Yeah, I think that I'm all in favor of anything that gives us an opportunity to sort of, I mean, if we're going to take like a scientific approach to this, anything that puts us in a position to like create these shades of distinction that help us create more refined tools or more refined ways of kind of looking at these things. And so I think what lies at the heart of what you've said, and you said it yourself in different words, I think, is that, you know, the darkest moment is going to be tied to that primary conflict, right? Like that's where it lies. It's part of plot. And then we have this dark night of the soul. This is tied to character. And it creates this, like, you know, multidimensionality, which is apparently a word I'm going to use a million times in this podcast, but it is something that I really like and appreciate. And to further the point that you stated before, you're going to have novels where these are the same thing. Those are going to be the novels in which the primary conflict is an internal conflict. If you have a primary conflict that is an external conflict where you have a character going against an antagonizing force that is outside of them or is, you know, an other, so to speak, however you want to establish that, then, you know, we might have the darkest moment coincide with that dark night of the soul. But as you said, they don't necessarily have to coincide. So I was writing down these notes as you spoke, and then a second later you said everything I wrote down. So we are on the literal same page of my notepad about this one.
Literal same page.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, like, when I think about it, because I had jotted down some examples, and then they're both actually romances, and they sort of don't support what I just said about romance possibly being an area where Dark Night of the Soul and The Darkest Moment are the same, because I actually find it really effective when most effective when the main character or main characters hit their dark night of the soul moment before the novel's darkest moment, because mm-hmm. what that does is it raises the stakes. They have done the work. They've chosen to continue on that path and persevere, and they have grown from their experiences and have changed, and they have sacrificed, right? And then, despite all that, despite how far they've come, there is still this moment when it looks like they are not going to have a triumphant resolution to the primary conflict. So I like to think about it that way. Like just one example, you know, I love to talk about Pride and Prejudice.
Yes. I saw it in the notes. I was like, all right, let's do it.
So I'm thinking about Lizzie, and I would say that her dark night of the soul, her ego death, happens around 50% of the way through when she reads the letter from Darcy and she realizes how wrong she has been about the whole situation. She had it totally backwards. She trusted Wickham and despised Darcy, and she had such pride in her own ability to form impressions of people, accurate impressions of people, and this is her ego death moment. This is her dark night of the soul. And that happens, like I said, about 50% of the way through. But the darkest moment of the story is after she realizes that she wants to be with Darcy, that she loves him, but thinking that her chance is lost because of this whole Lydia Wickham elopement thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought up the point in the story at which that dark night of the soul occurs, because, you know, you put it at the 50% mark, and I was going to actually frame where I thought it would land. based on if we're using like that 7-point plot structure, I was going to say the midpoint. And the reason that I think it works well at the midpoint, which granted doesn't have to be the exact 50%, but in that plot structure, it's just called midpoint. The midpoint is the moment where a character comes into the knowledge that they're going to need to prepare themselves for the final road to take on, you know, the big baddie, whether that's an external or an internal force, totally depends on the narrative. But that midpoint is, I now have the, if we're going to use my Legend of Zelda, you know, examples from previous episodes, this is where we get the Master Sword, for example. This is going to allow us to travel between the present and past timelines and actually go into the dungeons that will lead us to, say, you know, Ganon or Ganondorf. Granted, in this particular instance, that Dark Night of the Soul, it's a video game. We don't have a huge emotional arc here, of course, but that we're using that as an example. It's kind of a stand-in for what that could be. In this case, it's a physical item, but in these narratives that are more about the inner journey, where we have that inner conflict as the primary conflict, that midpoint's going to be where they finally have that realization about themselves. And that's going, that reframing that's thrust upon them puts them in a position to go, wow, if only I had known this all along, I could have been on the right track. So different mm-hmm. names for the same thing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, yeah, it can correspond to the turning point. I don't think it necessarily has to. I think there's some wiggle room in the timing. The other example that I had thought of was Gone with the Wind, yet another romance. And I'm thinking about the film here and not the book, because I have not read the book. Please don't stone me to death. Okay, so Gone with the Wind. I think Scarlet's Dark Night of the Soul is when she's really, okay, so Rhett pushed her down the stairs and she had a miscarriage and now she's really sick. And she is feverish and hallucinating and she wants Rhett and calls for him, but people don't understand what she's saying. And then she says, it's no use. And so that's her moment when she thinks it doesn't matter how bad things get or how badly I need him, or even if I actually put my pride aside and call out for him, he doesn't want me. And so, I haven't actually looked at the timing of it, but it happens pretty close toward the end. It's like definitely 75% or later, I'm going to say. But the darkest moment is the very last scene when he walks out on her. And it's that famous line, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. That's the darkest moment of that. So I do think there's wiggle room in like when the darkest dark night of the soul happens. But I do like, I think your point about it corresponding to the turning point, it could correspond to the turning point. Very well taken. I think that's a great example.
And I think, you know, as we advance through this conversation, the next question that we've been set up for here is whether all novels need a darkest moment. And I think that we have kind of, to this point, covered the importance of it. I think that the answer is kind of yes. I mean, it feels like it's kind of self-evident. It argues for itself in many ways. But let's take a minute and explore it, just to maybe double down on some of what we've covered so far. We had more input here from Angela on Twitter. Angela had this to say about whether we need a darkest moment. I think so. If your main character doesn't lose everything at some point in the story, is the story going to be as fulfilling when he, she, they win at the end, or as bleak if they lose? Your characters have to choose their path, and the darkest moment is their worst moment of choice. So some arguments there for, yes, we do in fact need a darkest moment in our novels.
And is that how you think about it too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do. I think inherently, I think it would be really hard to write a novel without a darkest moment. I mean, I think you could do it, but I think if we have any sort of journey that we're putting our character on emotionally, there will be at least one moment that is darkest relative to the others, I guess. I mean, I'm trying to think of a novel I've read where I've just felt like I didn't have that big moment of impending doom at any point. I mean, surely I have, but maybe it's because I went into this conversation with a very pro darkest moment bias that I just ignored any counterexamples. But I don't know. I can't imagine putting down a book I can't imagine reading something that doesn't have a darkest moment and putting that book down and going, yeah, that was a good one. I just feel like it is the, it's the punctuation mark at the end of the sentence to the character's emotional journey and their relationship to the primary conflict. I think it all, I think we need it. Otherwise, we're just kind of left, we're left hanging. We're left feeling like it was blasé, like everything kind of came up flat. That's kind of where I stand on it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that emotional roller coaster that I go on when I get into a novel. Or, I mean, really any story, but I haven't thought about how this applies so much to short stories. But novels in particular, like, I really enjoy that. And if you don't have that sort of, like, plummeting free fall, like, oh, bleep moment... then like I agree with you, it would feel to me, I think, like something was missing, because, and a lot of that comes from, like, even though we don't know it, we're trained as readers to expect it and to want it, and that's just part of. Now, that said, when I say that, I'm referring to Western modes of storytelling, and there might be structures and modes of storytelling in other cultures that I'm unfamiliar with that don't have a darkest moment, and so I don't want to like be too xenocentric in this, but at least for what we're talking about in the Western modes of storytelling, I really, because, you know, I love my devil's advocate stuff, so I really tried hard to think about an example where, and I mean, the one genre that came up for me immediately where you might not have a darkest moment would be cozy mystery, because the whole point of cozy mystery is you know that things are going to be okay. But even then, there's a darkest moment. There's always a darkest moment. So, yeah.
It's hard to imagine something without it. I mean, like you said, we're trained to anticipate it. And so also that probably plays into both of our, you know, seeming inability to conjure like a really good counterexample. But also, so here's the thing. Surely someone listening to this podcast is going to be able to think of something that like didn't have a darkest moment. And the question is, will that story stand the test of time in your mind and in your heart? Probably not. And if it does, it probably could have stood that test of time a little more if it had that emotional anchor. That's the argument I would make anyway. I don't know how you feel about that.
I think it's interesting that that standing the test of time is the gauge. I think a story can be effective in the moment in which it was written. You know what I mean? That it doesn't have to stand the test of time in order to be effective in some moment.
Yeah, and I've set the bar admittedly high, mostly because
it's pretty high.
Yeah,
but I would say if you're listening to this and you can think of a good example of a book that you found satisfying and effective that does not have an all is lost moment related to the primary conflict, please at me on Twitter, because I want to check this out.
Yeah,
you can. I'm really interested.
Yeah, you can find Sion at Write, Learn, Dream, or I'm at IMRR Campbell, or even email us, writescast@gmail.com. We'll take a look. We're very curious. So,
so from there, if you don't mind, I was going to transition here into the next question. From can you have no darkest moment? Can you have more than one darkest moment in a novel? And we had a couple of different answers. Sina said, I think yes and no, depending on what we call the darkest moment. I think for each definition, there can only be one darkest moment, but you can have a darkest moral moment and a darkest situational moment in the same story. I think he's talking there about what we were talking about earlier. Darkest moral moment is about the character arc. Darkest situational moment is about the darkest moment for the primary conflict. Is that how you...
Yeah, you know, at first I was trying to, in my never-ending quest, to find different shades of meaning and create a million different, overcomplicated at times, examples of things. I was trying to find a way to, like, separate those examples from the notion of Dark Night of the Soul and just the darkest moment as it pertains to primary conflict. But reading it again now, I do think that it's really it really is pulling at that. You know, that darkest moral moment is, I think, inherently going to tie into character in some way. I mean, I would hope anyway, especially in fiction. Nonfiction would be another matter, but we don't do nonfiction here mostly, so we'll keep it in the world of fiction. And then that darkest situational moment, yeah, that feels like the darkest moment, kind of as we described it earlier, being connected to the primary conflict. So those were Cinna's thoughts. Angela also had something to say on this one. Question again, can we have more than one darkest moment? Angela says, I don't think so. The whole comparative EST thing means that it is the cumulative moment of bad, which is a great phrase. I love that phrase. The worst that can happen, the stakiest part of the stakes that you've written. The other moments are just the writer torturing his, her, their victims, capital L-O-L. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of like that. I think that, you know, if we're going to consider Dark Night of the Soul to be different fundamentally from Darkest Moment, then we can go ahead and embrace Angela's definition here, where that comparative EST ending, we're talking about stakes, which is going to be, actually, I was going to say stakes is going to be tied to plot, but it's tied to both plot and character. So I'm backing myself into a corner here and questioning everything I've ever known.
That's the whole purpose of these conversations. Yeah, right? No,
but it's good. So I think that what we're seeing here, I'm going to try and frame this as best I can on off the cuff. So Cinna is making this distinction, as we have made a distinction between, you know, Dark Night of the Soul and Darkest Moment. And Angela is looking at this and kind of linking them. So maybe we're exploring it through Angela's definition with this notion of stories where the darkest moment happens to coincide with the darkest night of the soul. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So it's all about, yeah, so it's all about the kind of story you're telling again. It's that, is our primary conflict an external conflict in which we might have these moments where Dark Night of the Soul occurs at a different point than Darkest Moment? Or are we talking about an internal conflict where these are, in many cases, probably just going to happen to be at the same time? Four people, one study, the internet access brain implant to bind or destroy them all. Now available in print and ebook from author R.R. Campbell and Nine Star Press, it's Imminent Dawn, the first book in the epic empathy sci-fi saga. Learn more about the book reviewers are calling freaking sci-fi Game of Thrones and an incisive techno-thriller that gets more tense with every page by visiting empathyseries.com. That's empathyseries.com. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm.
So that's those are the thoughts that I have on that. They've really thrown me for a loop. I threw myself for a loop. But where do you come down on this one?
I actually can think of examples where there are multiple darkest moments in the way that I've defined it, in a moment that it looks like all is lost related to the primary conflict. So I'm going to keep coming back to that definition because that's how I that's my anchor, right? So when I'm thinking about, and actually one example here, I'm curious about your perspective on it. When I was thinking about this, I thought about Lord of the Rings, and I thought about that moment when and I think it happens in both the book and the movie, but I've seen the movie more than I've read the book. But you know that moment when they're up on the path at, what is it, Cirith Ingle? Oh my God, people are gonna hate me for mispronouncing things. I'm just gonna stop trying. Anyway, so they made it through Shelob's cave, right? They climbed the stairs, made it through the cave, come out on the other side. They got separated in there, and then Frodo starts to climb, and then Shelob stabs him in the back with her stinger and then wraps him up. Oh my God, what a great moment. I think I gasped aloud the first time I saw it. But I was thinking that that would be an example of a darkest moment, because what I am thinking is going to happen is Shelob's going to take him back into the cave, and the ring is going to be lost again. And it's, Smeagol, what's his name? Gollum. Gollum. Is gonna, you know, hang around and get the ring and run off with it again. It's gonna be lost for thousands and thousands of years, and that's gonna be too late because what's his face? Ugh. Sauron.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
I'm failing big time here. I don't know what the problem is. Anyway, okay. So, yeah. So I was thinking that is an example of a darkest moment, because it looks for a moment like the ring is going to be lost again and Sauron's going to win. What do you think about that?
I think, and just to, you know, really drive the point home, we're talking about that as a darkest moment, but then the idea is that there is a darkest moment that occurs later, correct? Like, also a darkest moment?
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, thank you for getting me back on track here, as why I think there's two darkest moments, at least in this book. So that's one, and then, but the later darkest moment is after they've gotten into the volcano, and now it is Frodo's time to drop the ring into the fires into which the ring was forged and destroy it forever. And then he's like, no, I think I'm going to keep it. And he turns around and starts walking away. And that's another darkest moment.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you used this example, because to kind of tie it back into kind of how I was pitching the scene that I finished writing this morning, where we have this cliffhanger and it feels like a darkest moment, but it's happening pretty early in the book. It actually sounds really, what I'm doing in this scene actually sounds really similar to how it plays out in Lord of the Rings, actually, like just on a, if you strip it down to the elemental level. I know you're making a face at me. I'm not trying to compare myself to Lord of the Rings. I think we're talking about it in terms of, you know, a plot device. If you really break it down that way, there's this like, oh my God, no, all is lost. We are losing our character. There's almost an analog in this scene, now that I think about it, where I've accidentally created a ring-like item in this universe. I know it's terrible. I'm stumbling into this just now.
You were doing it, and now you've given the whole book away.
Well, okay. Yes and no, honestly. I mean, I have a blog post that will be out by the time this episode's out, where I talk specifically about how to look at characters as they come and go from the empathy series, because reviewers have been very concerned about a particular character maybe not making it to the end of book one. They're kind of, it's left a little unresolved. So I had to step out into the universe and say, like, namaste everyone, it's going to be okay, just keep reading, let's be patient. Anyway, so yeah, I actually think you make some really good points there. I think that's a perfect example, and it's also very accessible, because it's something that most people, I mean, me, I couldn't read the series. I've seen the movies once. They're good movies. It just wasn't for me. But it's a really accessible example, because you know those moments, even if you're tangentially familiar. So I think that I am now very much in agreement with you that, yes, we can have multiple darkest moments, because one, you've given a great example, and two, it lets me justify a choice that I made in my own manuscript.
Always love that.
Yeah.
So that's one example. What I want to say about darkest moments, well, because also, like, if your story is a series of missions that build on each other, and you have to complete this mission successfully in order to, I know I'm sort of talking about it in video game language, but I can't think of a particular book, but I'm just thinking about, like, if you don't complete this mission successfully, then you can't sort of move on to the next level, if you will. you can't do the next one successfully, and so you can have darkest moments within each of those things that all act as darkest moments in the primary conflict, because you're making that correlation. Like, we know that if they don't get the amulet from the cave at the top of Mount Ting Ting,
mm-hmm.
then there's no way they can do the next thing they need to do and go on. What I'm coming to in this is it's about pacing, and also please don't exhaust my adrenal glands by having a darkest moment, like, you know, too early, first of all. And the other thing that I want to say is, like, if you do have earlier darkest moments, I am going to expect that each subsequent darkest moment is more impactful than the previous one. So you are setting yourself a very difficult task, but it's possible.
Agreed. There we have it. Our next question. We were going to talk for a little bit about the point in a manuscript when darkest moments should occur. I actually think we've covered that, fairly decently a bit earlier in the conversation. So unless there are any objections, let's maybe roll into, I see your hand is up. Is that an objection?
Yep. Well, it's not an objection. The only thing I want to add there is if you do only have one darkest moment in your book, which is totally fine, we will be very satisfied with that. No earlier than the 75% mark. The whole point is you need to build up the stakes around it in order for it to achieve its full emotional impact. And then I prefer more in like the 80% to 95% range. I find that that's what's most satisfying to me.
Bam. There it is. We've got it. We've stuck the landing on the location for darkest moments in our manuscript. So with that in mind, you know, we know that we got to have it. We got to have it somewhere in this range that we've established. But perhaps even more importantly, how do we set readers up for a darkest moment? I have to imagine it's not something that we just decide, ta-da, this is the moment when all is lost. It better resonate with you, dear reader. How is it that we actually set people up for that darkest moment?
It's a great question, Ryan. What do you think?
What do I think? I think that I'm going to just read your notes and steal them. No, I'm just kidding. I do think, though, that to really set it up, we have to have a foundational, deep understanding of our characters. And I know that we've talked about, you know, insofar as dark moments are concerned, when it's tied to character and, you know, questioning morals, etc., we're talking about a dark night of the soul. We've kind of made that distinction. But I think that with everything in storytelling, kind of coming back to character, figuring out what the darkest moment is going to be for them, whether it's in the dimension of their internal journey or the dimension of their external journey, we really have to have a solid understanding, not only as the writer of who these characters are as people, but making sure that we presented that effectively to readers. And that's, I mean, there's a reason we could do a whole episode on how that is done, of course, but I think it all depends on, again, using the stitching method or like a breadcrumb method. You know, how can we use nuance and foreshadowing and create questions in our character's mind about like what that worst thing might be, you know, like what would happen if all was lost. And I'm not saying we need to do a bunch of navel gazing where a character spends, you know, a couple of paragraphs in every chapter reflecting on that. But I think if we even have like two or three moments sprinkled throughout where there is this consideration of what would happen if, in Cinna's example earlier, what would happen if I surrendered to this temptation and became, you know, this villain? Or what would happen if I were to fail, you know, at either this critical juncture or at a juncture that I anticipate finding myself at down the road? Teasing that here and there in critical moments can really go a long way into making sure that once we actually reach the moment in which these fears are being realized, can really land, and then we'll know that we haven't created a situation where character strolls through their journey, they get to the end, and poof, everything's a huge surprise even for them. We want to have our characters actively participating in the action and actively considering, in most cases, what the consequences for their actions might be. And so long as characters are in that position, I think that we're doing a decent job setting ourselves up for that darkest moment.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I'm hearing you say is that the stakes need to be really clear.
Yes.
If the stakes aren't really clear, then that all is lost moment, that darkest moment, or the dark night of the soul, whatever, however we're defining that, is just not going to have it's not going to land.
Yeah, it won't have any weight to it. It's like it'll come and go, and we might not feel invested, or we might not understand the consequences, of course, tying into stakes, as you've put it here. Yeah, if we don't know, if it kind of reaches the end and we're like, well, they've had a darkest moment and readers are left going, so what? That means that we haven't provided enough clarity regarding those stakes and regarding our character's connection to those stakes and the consequences for their failure or success.
Yeah, so, and I would just add to that, have a really clear primary conflict. Like, as you're writing, you need to be really clear about what your primary conflict is and how the darkest moment that you are writing relates to it, whether it's related to an external conflict or an internal conflict, like we were talking about. Sometimes I've seen darkest moments go awry because there wasn't that clarity about whether the primary conflict was external or internal, this goes back to something else you said about sort of the obvious answer being a character death. Like, what happens is we get to the climax, and maybe it's a battle scene, and one of the main characters, it looks like they have died. Well, obviously that's a dark moment, because if we love that main character, that's a thing that we don't want to happen. So that's a dark moment. But if we know that the primary conflict can still be successfully resolved, if that character dies, it's not the darkest moment. And that is the most common issue that I see when I'm editing manuscripts. Either that, or the primary conflict has gotten confused with the series conflict, which we've talked about in a different episode, so I will not go into detail about that one here. But
good to point it out, though. It is something that listeners, if you want to pop in and check out that Writing a Series episode, that's going to be at writescast.net/podcasts/novel approaches.
Yeah. Last little thing about this is there needs to be some relationship, and I'm going to get real nebulous, between the first 50 pages between Act One of the novel and the darkest moment. Now, I can't tell you what that relationship should be, because there are a lot of successful relationships that it can have. But if there is no relationship, then that means I was not set up very well for what this book is actually about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. It's actually something that many moons ago, when I was working with you and you were editing the first 50 pages of Empathy, the first book in the series at the time, I think there was a reason that you asked for the first 50 pages, and then there was also a buffer at the end. You wanted to see that darkest moment to find the correlation between the two. And one of the things that I realized based on your feedback on that draft was there was some connection, but not quite strong enough to really make sure that we were setting ourselves up for that darkest moment at the end. So there it is. It's the practicing what you preach kind of thing. And it all works out. I say, quote unquote, knowing the trajectory of the series and how it actually plays out in that book anyway. But no, that's very good and obviously resonates with me.
I'm blushing over here that you brought that up. Thank
you.
Oh,
I can see that. No, I mean, it reminded me of that immediately. And I was like, oh, that's why she, you know, does the first 50 plus darkest moment package. That's brilliant. That's great. I love that.
The ending. Yeah.
No, it's very good. It's very good.
So what, and this is a question that I think you might have more to say about than I do, but what are the relationships between a character's fatal flaw and the darkest moment, and between the theme and the darkest moment?
Yeah, so this one is, you know, you just mentioned maybe getting a little nebulous. I think what I'm going to do to help myself maybe be a little less nebulous on this, I'm going to go ahead and read Cinna's answer to this and see if that kind of helps me stumble my way into how I would choose to frame it. But Cinna mentioned that for his current work in progress, the character's flaw allows the door to open for them to become the villain, to take the easy, low path. It's right there. And the theme is communication in his work in progress. There are many ways to communicate, to connect. Force can't change the heart, though. So I'm glad that I read that, because it does remind me of the example that he gave earlier, which was this notion that the character's fatal flaw, perhaps in this case, is that they're easily tempted. Let's just roll with that as a possible fatal flaw for a character. And they find themselves, you know, at this juncture in their journey where suddenly they have the opportunity to get everything that they want, but perhaps not in the way that they would have expected getting it. And in this case, the way that they can get it is by becoming that villain. What we've done is we've created this fatal flaw that's been teased throughout. There have been maybe some pivot points along the way, if we're using that sort of like scene structure language, at which we've seen this character surrender to the fatal flaw, like in these in the margins, so to speak. They haven't like ceded so much ground that they've become a villain early on, but occasionally they find themselves tempted. Maybe it leads them on a short, trail that gets them still working toward the primary conflict, but not in the dimension that we would have expected them. So we have this anticipation of, okay, I know what this is making this character vulnerable. Let's have that darkest moment tie into that vulnerability. Let's have it tie into that greatest fear. And that can be the moment where we get a teaching lesson, like a teaching moment as well. A character could go through an entire novel not really understanding that they have this fatal flaw, but then we get to this darkest moment and they suddenly go, oh my goodness, this is because where the darkest moment is possibly tied to a dark night of the soul. They go, oh my goodness, here's a thing I'm learning about myself in this moment. I now need to, take action A or action B, depending on whether or not I want to surrender to this fatal flaw as I have been doing throughout my life and perhaps not realized it, or if I want to try to become the person that I think I might be able to become by not surrendering to that fatal flaw. And I think all of that, if you have that journey for your character stitched throughout the manuscript, that will inherently tie to theme, because there is such a really tremendous relationship, I think, between a character's arc and theme. You know, what's important to them at the start of the novel, what's important to them at the end of the novel, how do we get from A to B, and we kind of take the meta, so to speak, that's happening in between, and that can kind of become the manifestation of our theme tied into fatal flaws, darkest moments, what have you. So that's my riff on it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's clear to me, especially in the case where the darkest moment corresponds to the dark night of the soul, that the character's fatal flaw would come into play there. I think ideally, even if those two points are different, and the darkest moment is only related to the external conflict, I think ideally the character's fatal flaw would come into play, which is to say they got through their dark night of the soul and changed, like they learned a new strategy or they overcame it or they grew, and that is going to enable them to triumph at the resolution, and it's gonna be there, just maybe not as directly engaged as what you were talking about. Also, though, I gotta say that I can think of examples where it's a successful darkest moment, even if the character's fatal flaw is not engaged. So there's that.
There are options. It's that multidimensionality. You know, we're talking, of course, in generalities, and it sounds like, I kind of like how for every question, almost every question here, we've had like a yes, but no, or a yes and no kind of thing going on. And I think, you know, if you're a listener to this show, maybe you're earlier in your writing journey, like prepare yourself, because that's going to be the answer to a lot of things. And I think what it comes down to, though, is like that can be confusing and it can be frustrating, but it's also really freeing, because what it means is that, you know, there isn't a single right way to do all of this. It just depends on the parameters that we want to work within for our stories. At least that's how I'm going to try to pitch it right now anyway.
Yeah, I'm glad that you pointed that out, because it can seem like, yeah, everything's clear as mud at the end of this. And actually, what I love about these conversations, especially recently, is that we're diving into making it more complex and not trying to oversimplify. And I really appreciate that about the online chats, too, is because there are so many different perspectives. And, like, nobody's wrong. That's the thing. It's like, nobody's wrong. We all have different perspectives. And there are lots of effective ways to do things. So what you said.
There it is. Well, we have a question here now, too. We'll get our listener question worked in. This one is from Cinna. Cinna kind of turns the whole conversation on its head when he asks specifically about, we've got darkest moments, right? Well, he asks, is there a brightest moment? Is that just the victory lap at the end or the moment before it all goes wrong? Like, just in general, is there an antithesis to the darkest moment? So I see you've got some notes on this question here. What do you think about that question?
Yeah, it's an intriguing question. I'm going to come back to my definition of darkest moment, which is all is lost regarding the primary conflict. So if we're looking for an opposite, it would mean that all is gained regarding the primary conflict. And I would argue, too, that now I'm going to break my own rule and swoop in the character's goals as well. Because when I think about all is gained, it's not just triumphant resolution of the primary conflict, but also all the characters get everything they want. Their personal goals are achieved as well. My first reaction is, like, I hope not. Because that would, I think that would feel too sweet and neat. If the characters get everything they want. And I really like more bittersweet endings. I like, as Angela Super was talking about earlier, I need that sense of loss or sacrifice in order for the story to feel satisfying. Even if that loss is the loss of pride or something else the character was holding on to that wasn't serving them very well anymore, even if that loss is actually also kind of a gain, it is an ego death in the way. And there is some grieving that happens every time you sort of enter a new phase of your life, right? Because things aren't the same anymore. But then I think, like, is there an example of a book or a kind of a book where it's fairly common for the characters to get everything they want? Actually, romance, again, is the exception. Because, and I can think of, like, romance, they not only get together with their love interest, but they also, I read a lot of historical romance, that allows them to the feisty female heroine to go ahead and, like, be a feminist and actually be protected by usually her husband's, in these tales, wealth and status. It allows her to be more fully who she is, which is one of the things I really appreciate about these narratives. And so that's more of an all is gained situation. So I've just argued for both sides of it. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are certainly bright moments throughout a manuscript. I mean, I feel like if we're talking about genre-related matters, you know, you see this term thrown around that's like grimdark, and I couldn't necessarily define that, but I think if we take those words for what they're worth kind of at face value, I can see how you might have a story where it's just like dark moment after dark moment after dark moment. And at that point, I think everything kind of becomes relative, you know? Once you kind of put yourself in a position where the tone of a novel is just going to be dark, I think you have to start judging brightness and darkness relative to the tone that's been established. So I have to imagine that even in something like that, you're going to get bright moments. I think if you're going to have a brightest moment, though, that could, in many cases, either be the moment where they've secured that victory, you know, they've overcome the primary conflict, they have emerged victorious, or in narratives perhaps where they don't emerge victorious at the end, the brightest moment could simply be seen as the moment where they had the revelation or they got the item that they needed to put themselves on the path to finally feel empowered or to be empowered to take on the big baddie or the primary, you know, the source of the primary conflict. So I think that brightest moment exists. I'm not particularly sure that, I don't know, I just can't imagine that we would be able to do an hour's worth of programming about something like that, though, because I think that the brightest moment exists perhaps only relative to darkest, to the darkest moment, so to speak.
I think that's a really excellent point about it being relative to the overall tone of the novel. And when you were talking about that in Grimdark, not that this is Grimdark, but I was thinking about how one of my favorite, I don't use this, but when I read books, I love it when the character achieves an immediate goal. And then that ends up, that's because it's what they think they want or need. And then that ends up making things worse. I freaking love that. That's such an amazing twist. And so I could see how in that situation, that your bright moment is also a dark moment, which is wonderful.
It's good. I like that. It's that bittersweet. You and I both love that bittersweet. I think that's perfect. I'm into that.
I do. Yeah.
Pretty good. Cool. Well, I think we've covered all the questions we had before us today. So let's talk about what we're going to have for the topic in our next episode of Novel Approaches. As usual, I will go ahead and put a poll up on Twitter after this episode has debuted. That poll will be up for a week, and we will ask you, our listeners, what it is that we should cover for our next RightsCast chat and for our next episode topic. This time around, we're going to have two mainstays. They were not selected for this episode, but we'll keep them in the poll for next time. You'll be able to choose from inciting incidents. That'll be the first option. There'll be third option storytelling, which has been in the poll for a couple times now. Again, third option storytelling is all about pushing past the first idea, the first thought that comes to mind, or finding ways to give our characters opportunities to look for an option that it may not seem exists to them at first glance. So that would be third option storytelling. And the new topic we're introducing to the poll this time around is something we talked about briefly in this episode, and that is fatal flaws. So listeners, you have an opportunity to vote for one of those three topics, or also select other, where you can leave in the comments something you think we should consider covering in future episodes, putting in these polls, and leaving it up to the community to see what it is that is of interest to everyone. So we'll have the results of that poll up on Twitter, of course. We'll put a blog post on rightscast.net once the topic has been chosen, and that's where we'll let you know when the RightsCast chat is going to be, as well as when that episode will debut. So thank you, as always, for joining us for this episode of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network.
For more writerly podcast content like this, visit rightscast.net or follow us on Twitter at RightsCast. I'm also on Twitter at WriteLearnDream, and I'd love to connect with you and hear what you're working on.
And I'm over on Twitter as at IamRRCampbell. And I also want to make sure that we thank our patrons at patreon.com/RightsCast. Folks can head on over to our Patreon page where they can choose to contribute at $1, $2, $3 per episode. You can do $1, $2, $3 per month, whatever works for you. If you really like this programming and these conversations, it's a great way to help this podcast network become self-sustaining. And not only that, but you'll get some nice little perks in exchange for that. I've got some RightsCast Network swag available, stickers, things of that nature. You'll get discounts on my editing services. That's available at one of the tiers. And then, of course, you will always get, no matter how much you contribute on a monthly or per episode basis, exclusive early ad-free access to all of our episodes. I get those up at least 5 days in advance. Sometimes it's 2 weeks, sometimes it's a month. You'll have plenty of opportunities there.
And one of the things I really appreciate about that is that I then get emails that tell me when new content is available, and then I don't have to think about it. So I really appreciate that part of being a patron.
Yeah, you'll get the update right in your inbox. And if maybe you're not someone who's in a position to become a patron right now, you know, just go ahead and let another writer in your life know about our programming, or go ahead and leave a rating and review on iTunes. Those are really great ways to increase our visibility as well and make sure that we spread the love throughout the community. So that's patreon.com/rightscast. I'd appreciate any help that you're willing to give. So thanks for that.
And we'd especially like to thank Kristen Oakley, whose contributions at the Time Traveling Wizard, aka Wise Mentor level, get her shout outs in every RightsCast Network episode, on top of all the other great rewards she receives.
So like I said earlier, that's patreon.com/rightscast if you'd like to become a contributor. That's the wonderful home of all our patronly goodness on the interweb. So next up on the RightsCast Network, we'll have an episode with Damian Serbu, who will join me for a conversation about self-editing and revisions. That episode will debut on April 19th.
That's all for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, write on and write well.
This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net.